Welcome to Words to Live By, a podcast series hosted by the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute. Each week, we will share some of the wit and wisdom of Ronald Reagan. In essence, Words to Live By, made up of radio addresses and speeches he delivered from the 1960s through the 1980s. So let's review a bit. Recall when Jimmy Carter became president in the late 70s, believing the Soviets were not a threat, he canceled the B-1 bomber program and significantly reduced the American defense budget. What that did was to essentially force the U.S. to accept nuclear parity with the Soviet Union. And yes, there was SALT I, the SALT I treaty, which recognized the Soviet Union as equal in every respect. SALT II was never ratified by Congress. Without ratification, both countries, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, were still supposed to hold to the terms. Of course, the Soviets ignored them. They invaded Afghanistan and deployed 200 SS-20 missiles in East Germany, causing Europe to beg for help. Chancellor of West Germany Helmut Schmidt was frantic because the SS-20 was a new kind of missile. All of Europe was within its range, which was about 2,300 kilometers. The missile had three warheads, and it was mobile, so it could easily be moved around wherever the Soviets needed. In light of such aggression, Governor Ronald Reagan said the Soviets used détente as a one-way street to pursue its own aims, the promotion of revolution, and a one-world communist state. And the Europeans? Well, they claimed the Soviets had placed a gun to their heads. When Ronald Reagan became president, he clearly recognized the threat and listened to the desperate pleas by European world leaders, mostly in private. Because if public statements were made by those European leaders, the Soviets would shut off their energy supply. Sound familiar? Well, after President Reagan significantly increased the defense budget, our resolve to deploy cruise and Pershing II missiles to counterbalance the Soviet deployment of the SS-20s became intense. But the president had a better idea, a defensive weapon known as the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI, which was rolled out to the American people in a national televised address 40 years ago this month. In this podcast, we're going to look at some of the principles of this idea, but first, let's begin with the president's description of the Soviet buildup. Let's listen.
For 20 years, the Soviet Union has been accumulating enormous military might. They didn't stop when their forces exceeded all requirements of a legitimate defensive capability, and they haven't stopped now. During the past decade and a half, the Soviets have built up a massive arsenal of new strategic nuclear weapons, weapons that can strike directly at the United States. As an example, the United States introduced its last new intercontinental ballistic missile, the Minuteman III, in 1969. And we're now dismantling our even older Titan missiles. But what has the Soviet Union done in these intervening years? Well, since 1969, the Soviet Union has built five new classes of ICBMs and upgraded these eight times. As a result, their missiles are much more powerful and accurate than they were several years ago, and they continue to develop more, while ours are increasingly obsolete. The same thing has happened in other areas. Over the same period, the Soviet Union built four new classes of submarine-launched ballistic missiles and over 60 new missile submarines. We built two new types of submarine missiles and actually withdrew 10 submarines from strategic missions. The Soviet Union built over 200 new backfire bombers, and their brand new Blackjack bomber is now under development. We haven't built a new long-range bomber since our B-52s were deployed about a quarter of a century ago, and we've already retired several hundred of those because of old age. Indeed, despite what many people think, our strategic forces only cost about 15% of the defense budget. Another example of what's happened. In 1978, the Soviets had 600 intermediate-range nuclear missiles based on land and were beginning to add the SS-20, a new, highly accurate mobile missile with three warheads. We had none. Since then, the Soviets have strengthened their lead. By the end of 1979, when Soviet leader Brezhnev declared a balance now exists, the Soviets had over 800 warheads. We still had none. A year ago this month, Mr. Brezhnev pledged a moratorium or freeze on SS-20 deployment. But by last August, their 800 warheads had become more than 1,200. We still had none, some freeze. At this time, Soviet Defense Minister Ustinov announced, approximate parity of forces continues to exist, but the Soviets are still adding an average of 3 new warheads a week and now have 1,300. These warheads can reach their targets in a matter of a few minutes. We still have none. So far, it seems that the Soviet definition of parity is a box score of 1,300 to nothing in their favor. So, together with our NATO allies, we decided in 1979 to deploy new weapons beginning this year as a deterrent to their SS-20s and as an incentive to the Soviet Union to meet us in serious arms control negotiations. We will begin that deployment late this year. At the same time, however, we're willing to cancel our program if the Soviets will dismantle theirs. This is what we've called a zero-zero plan. The Soviets are now at the negotiating table, and I think it's fair to say that without our planned deployments, they wouldn't be there. Now let's consider conventional forces. Since 1974, the United States has produced 3,050 tactical combat aircraft. By contrast, the Soviet Union has produced twice as many. When we look at attack submarines, the United States has produced 27, while the Soviet Union has produced 61. For armored vehicles, including tanks, we've produced 11,200. The Soviet Union has produced 54,000, nearly 5-1 in their favor. Finally, with artillery, we've produced 950 artillery and rocket launchers, while the Soviets have produced more than 13,000, a staggering 14-1 ratio. There was a time when we were able to offset superior Soviet numbers with higher quality, but today, they're building weapons as sophisticated and modern as our own.
Believing the Soviet deployment of SS-20s was a true disruption to international peace, not just a threat to America, President Reagan moved the nuclear weapons issue into a whole new dimension. On the 23rd of March, 1983, he proposed the Strategic Defense Initiative to develop a space-based anti-missile shield to protect the United States from Soviet attack. It was essentially a shield that could destroy incoming missiles in the ascent phase or before they reentered the Earth's atmosphere or reached their targets. Secretary of Defense Cap Weinberger said it offered mankind the hope of deterring a nuclear attack by military defenses, rather than by relying on guesses as to what the Soviets might think or what they might do. Senator Ted Kennedy, well, he derisively nicknamed the program Star Wars. And yes, SDI was expensive, but Walter Raymond of the National Security Council said it sent a loud message to the Soviets that we will spend you into poverty. Just a month after President Reagan delivered this speech, Soviet General Secretary Andropov suggested a meeting of Soviet and U.S. scientists to discuss its consequences. Kind of interesting. Wouldn't talk to us before, but now he will. And communist parties and front organizations around the world scrambled to denounce SDI because the idea had clearly hit a nerve. Let's listen to the first part of the rollout.
Tonight, I want to explain to you what this defense debate is all about and why I'm convinced that the budget now before the Congress is necessary, responsible, and deserving of your support. And I want to offer hope for the future. But first, let me say what the defense debate is not about. It is not about spending arithmetic. I know that in the last few weeks, you've been bombarded with numbers and percentages. Some say we need only a 5% increase in defense spending. The so-called alternate budget, backed by liberals in the House of Representatives, would lower the figure to 2-3%, cutting our defense spending by $163 billion over the next 5 years. The trouble with all these numbers is that they tell us little about the kind of defense program America needs, or the benefits in security and freedom that our defense effort buys for us. What seems to have been lost in all this debate is the simple truth of how a defense budget is arrived at. It isn't done by deciding to spend a certain number of dollars. Those loud voices that are occasionally heard charging that the government is trying to solve a security problem by throwing money at it are nothing more than noise based on ignorance. We start by considering what must be done to maintain peace and review all the possible threats against our security. Then, a strategy for strengthening peace and defending against those threats must be agreed upon. And finally, our defense establishment must be evaluated to see what is necessary to protect against any or all of the potential threats. The cost of achieving these ends is totaled up, and the result is the budget for national defense. There is no logical way that you can say, let's spend X billion dollars less. You can only say, which part of our defense measures do we believe we can do without and still have security against all contingencies? Anyone in the Congress who advocates a percentage or a specific dollar cut in defense spending should be made to say what part of our defenses he would eliminate, and he should be candid enough to acknowledge that his cuts mean cutting our commitments to allies or inviting greater risk or both. The defense policy of the United States is based on a simple premise. The United States does not start fights. We will never be an aggressor. We maintain our strength in order to deter and defend against aggression, to preserve freedom and peace. Since the dawn of the atomic age, we've sought to reduce the risk of war by maintaining a strong deterrent and by seeking genuine arms control. Deterrence means simply this: making sure any adversary who thinks about attacking the United States or our allies or our vital interests concludes that the risks to him outweigh any potential gains. Once he understands that, he won't attack. We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression. This strategy of deterrence has not changed. It still works. But what it takes to maintain deterrence has changed. It took one kind of military force to deter an attack when we had far more nuclear weapons than any other power. It takes another kind now that the Soviets, for example, have enough accurate and powerful nuclear weapons to destroy virtually all of our missiles on the ground. Now, this is not to say that the Soviet Union is planning to make war on us, nor do I believe a war is inevitable. Quite the contrary. But what must be recognized is that our security is based on being prepared to meet all threats. There was a time when we depended on coastal forts and artillery batteries because, with the weaponry of that day, any attack would have had to come by sea. Well, this is a different world, and our defenses must be based on recognition and awareness of the weaponry possessed by other nations in the nuclear age. We can't afford to believe we will never be threatened. There have been two world wars in my lifetime. We didn't start them, and indeed did everything we could to avoid being drawn into them. But we were ill-prepared for both. Had we been better prepared, peace might have been preserved.
More about SDI and the president's visual presentation with maps right after this message.
The Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation is the nonprofit organization created by President Reagan himself and specifically charged by him with continuing his legacy and sharing his principles: individual liberty, economic opportunity, global democracy, and national pride. We must remain vigilant and work together to share these conservative principles with younger generations. Your role is critical to move our mission forward. Thank you for your continued support. Please visit reaganfoundation.org/give. That's reaganfoundation.org/give.
Now, back to the story. President Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Cap Weinberger, said that the Soviets were plainly arming and preparing for aggressive action. If you move out with forward defenses so far that on one side you encompass, for example, most of the Pacific or a good bit of Europe on the other side, then you are clearly just not trying to protect your border. That's exactly what the president was determined to show by using visual aids or maps in his national address. And while there is no video associated with the podcast, try to envision what the president is saying as we listen to his description.
The following aerial photographs, most of them secret until now, illustrate this point in a crucial area very close to home, Central America and the Caribbean Basin. They're not dramatic photographs, but I think they help give you a better understanding of what I'm talking about. This Soviet intelligence collection facility, less than 100 miles from our coast, is the largest of its kind in the world. The acres and acres of antenna fields and intelligence monitors are targeted on key U.S. military installations and sensitive activities. The installation in Lourdes, Cuba, is manned by 1,500 Soviet technicians, and the satellite ground station allows instant communications with Moscow. This 28-square-mile facility has grown by more than 60% in size and capability during the past decade. In western Cuba, we see this military airfield and its complement of modern Soviet-built MiG-23 aircraft. The Soviet Union uses this Cuban airfield for its own long-range reconnaissance missions, and earlier this month, two modern Soviet anti-submarine warfare aircraft began operating from it. During the past 2 years, the level of Soviet arms exports to Cuba can only be compared to the levels reached during the Cuban Missile Crisis 20 years ago. This third photo, which is the only one in this series that has been previously made public, shows Soviet military hardware that has made its way to Central America. This airfield, with its Mi-8 helicopters, anti-aircraft guns, and protected fighter sites, is one of a number of military facilities in Nicaragua which has received Soviet equipment funneled through Cuba and reflects the massive military buildup going on in that country. On the small island of Grenada, at the southern end of the Caribbean chain, the Cubans, with Soviet financing and backing, are in the process of building an airfield with a 10,000-foot runway. Grenada doesn't even have an air force. Who is it intended for? The Caribbean is a very important passageway for our international commerce and military lines of communication. More than half of all American oil imports now pass through the Caribbean. The rapid buildup of Grenada's military potential is unrelated to any conceivable threat to this island country of under 110,000 people, and totally at odds with the pattern of other Eastern Caribbean states, most of which are unarmed. The Soviet-Cuban militarization of Grenada, in short, can only be seen as power projection into the region, and it is in this important economic and strategic area that we're trying to help the governments of El Salvador, Costa Rica, Honduras, and others in their struggles for democracy against guerrillas supported through Cuba and Nicaragua. These pictures only tell a small part of the story. I wish I could show you more without compromising our most sensitive intelligence sources and methods. But the Soviet Union is also supporting Cuban military forces in Angola and Ethiopia. They have bases in Ethiopia and South Yemen near the Persian Gulf oil fields. They have taken over the port that we built at Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam. And now, for the first time in history, the Soviet Navy is a force to be reckoned with in the South Pacific. Some people may still ask, would the Soviets ever use their formidable military power? Well, again, can we afford to believe they won't? There is Afghanistan, and in Poland, the Soviets denied the will of the people and, in so doing, demonstrated to the world how their military power could also be used to intimidate. The final fact is that the Soviet Union is acquiring what can only be considered an offensive military force. They have continued to build far more intercontinental ballistic missiles than they could possibly need simply to deter an attack. Their conventional forces are trained and equipped not so much to defend against an attack as they are to permit sudden surprise offensives of their own.
American intelligence reported that the Soviets had been working on a similar missile defense system for years, unsuccessfully, despite their objections to American technology. Ultimately, SDI became a key factor in negotiating arms reductions and indeed securing peace and freedom. Okay, so let's get to the payoff here. After a careful setup, the president hit the high notes. Let's listen.
After careful consultation with my advisors, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I believe there is a way. Let me share with you a vision of the future which offers hope. It is that we embark on a program to counter the awesome Soviet missile threat with measures that are defensive. Let us turn to the very strengths in technology that spawned our great industrial base and that have given us the quality of life we enjoy today. What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies? I know this is a formidable technical task, one that may not be accomplished before the end of this century. Yet current technology has attained a level of sophistication where it's reasonable for us to begin this effort. It will take years, probably decades, of effort on many fronts. There'll be failures and setbacks, just as there will be successes and breakthroughs. And as we proceed, we must remain constant in preserving the nuclear deterrent and maintaining a solid capability for flexible response. But isn't it worth every investment necessary to free the world from the threat of nuclear war? We know it is. In the meantime, we will continue to pursue real reductions in nuclear arms, negotiating from a position of strength that can be ensured only by modernizing our strategic forces. At the same time, we must take steps to reduce the risk of a conventional military conflict escalating to nuclear war by improving our non-nuclear capabilities. America does possess now the technologies to attain very significant improvements in the effectiveness of our conventional non-nuclear forces. Proceeding boldly with these new technologies, we can significantly reduce any incentive that the Soviet Union may have to threaten attack against the United States or its allies. As we pursue our goal of defensive technologies, we recognize that our allies rely upon our strategic offensive power to deter attacks against them. Their vital interests and ours are inextricably linked. Their safety and ours are one, and no change in technology can or will alter that reality. We must and shall continue to honor our commitments. I clearly recognize that defensive systems have limitations and raise certain problems and ambiguities. If paired with offensive systems, they can be viewed as fostering an aggressive policy, and no one wants that. But with these considerations firmly in mind, I call upon the scientific community in our country, those who gave us nuclear weapons, to turn their great talents now to the cause of mankind and world peace, to give us the means of rendering these nuclear weapons impotent and obsolete. Tonight, consistent with our obligations under the ABM Treaty and recognizing the need for closer consultation with our allies, I'm taking an important first step. I am directing a comprehensive and intensive effort to define a long-term research and development program to begin to achieve our ultimate goal of eliminating the threat posed by strategic nuclear missiles. This could pave the way for arms control measures to eliminate the weapons themselves. We seek neither military superiority nor political advantage. Our only purpose, one all people share, is to search for ways to reduce the danger of nuclear war. My fellow Americans, tonight we're launching an effort which holds the promise of changing the course of human history. There will be risks, and results take time, but I believe we can do it. As we cross this threshold, I ask for your prayers and your support. Thank you, good night, and God bless you.
Thank you for listening.
For more information on the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute, including information on how to become a member, information on upcoming exhibits at the Reagan Library, and more information on the legacy of President Reagan, please visit ReaganFoundation.org. And don't forget to like and follow the Reagan Foundation on all social media platforms.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Words to Live By podcast in your iTunes or Google Play stores and on other podcast platforms as they become available. New episodes of Words to Live By come out every Tuesday. Like what you hear? Check out our A Reagan Forum podcast featuring great speeches delivered at the Reagan Library. New episodes drop every Thursday. And don't forget to follow at Ronald Reagan on Facebook, at Ronald Reagan 40 on Twitter, and Reagan Foundation on YouTube. Also, search for us on SoundCloud and Stitcher.